Scotland Outdoors podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for downloading this. I'm Mark Stephen. As you know, we craft, lovingly craft, the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. This week, absolute carnage on the mystery bird front. Hello and a very good morning to you. I came out of the house this morning, 5:10, stone dark, absolutely stone dark. And incredibly, there was a curlew flying about the house. You could just hear that lovely trilling call. You know, as Rob McFarlane puts it, trailing bubbles of sound behind it. Beautiful. I'm Mark Stephen, coming to you live from the BBC Aberdeen car park. Joining me on this Easter weekend from his Banffshire hideaway, Mr. Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, well, I can't do curlews, but I've got about 300 rooks just irritating the heck out of everybody. Hey, what are you doing this morning? Any plans for the weekend? And any gardening?
Oh, yes.
Gardening on this programme. Give us a call, 0808 592 95 00. There you go. Sam's taking your calls this morning. You can text 80295. Loads of ways to get in touch, but we will tell you, 6:30 in the morning, you're too stressed out to take it all in, but we will give it to you.
Yeah. Now, talking of curlews, yesterday I was out in the back garden and there were two curlews flying more or less over our trees, and I'm thinking, they don't normally come in that close. I thought, that's odd. You know, and they were really agitated, very noisy, very, very noisy. And then I looked up and there was a sparrowhawk just kind of ghosting in behind them, and that was what was annoying them. We are going to be chatting all things gardening with Kirsty Wilson, who works at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Edinburgh, Scotland's top tourist attraction for 2020, as well as being a presenter on BBC Scotland's Beech Grove Garden. That's coming up later in the programme. Plus, we've got a wander around Cathcart Cemetery with author Peter Ross, and I'm back on my bike again. But first, Mystery Bird.
Yeah, possibly the whole highlight of the programme. Yeah, it's hard to believe. We've been doing this for a year. 1 year today.
How many birds are there?
Well, who would have thought there was that many birds? But there's loads, and there's another one this week. Have a wee guess to this. Now, you see, I would have thought that was quite easy. Yeah. But I'm expecting a lot of wrong answers. You don't know where that is, which
Well, I do now because I got to the end of the script. But
you've got a script?
Yeah, sort of. I think it's what it's meant to be. It looks awful like one.
Out of doors at bbc.co.uk. It's more of a code or a kind of general pointer of direction. Text 80295 and give Sam a call. 0808 592 95 00. Because I was on holiday last week, but I think you had quite a quiet week last week.
Yeah, well, true. Very quiet. Very, very quiet. Anyway, bikes. Bikes are like hen's teeth at the moment. See, trying to get hold of a bike online or anything of the kind, they're just, I mean, folk are just suddenly discovering cycling is a good way of getting about. You can actually cover more ground on a bicycle, you know, and therefore, they become a treasured possession. The other week, I took my bike, very carefully locked up, embarked upon a new route. It's called the Aberdeen Coastal Trail, and it runs from Cove to Donmouth or vice versa. I mean, it's ambidextrous, you can please yourself. I decided to start off at Cove, which lies just to the south of the city. I've come to the conclusion that Cove is the IKEA of Aberdeenshire. It's easy to get into, it's utterly impossible to get out of. I've managed to fight my way out to the outskirts of town, and I'm now looking down on the railway line with the sea behind it. It's a windy day, but it's nowhere near as bad as it was yesterday. I mean, yesterday was just ludicrous. I really haven't come terribly far away at all. I'm probably only about a mile away from Cove. But the coastal path does just exactly that. It follows the tops of the cliffs. You can hear behind me there's about 24 oyster catchers just making their way through this field. But in front of me, the slope goes down rough tussocky grass. But there's some kind of reed or long grass. I really can't identify it. I don't think I've ever seen it before. and it's standing up, and it produces this almost like an orange haze across the tops of the dark rocks. Out in the water, there's rafts of eider ducks. You can see fulmars flying. A couple of anglers down there in the point. That's quite unusual, seeing sea anglers round about here. But this is just lovely. You know, and if I were to walk 400 metres in that direction, industrial estate. And before that, I would have crossed a main railway line under road. There's gulls flying below me. I was kind of hopeful of seeing some dolphin action today, but so far, nothing. Early days yet, right enough. Now, though the waves aren't big, probably about a foot or so, they're hitting those rocks down there and just throwing up spumes of spray. I never said you wouldn't believe that there was a railway line behind me. Listen. About an 8-carriage unit, LNER. That's probably the London train. There's something strangely mesmeric about watching cloud shadow just crossing the sea. That's lovely. You can see these from the railway line too, but this part of the coastline is just littered in these geos. In a really narrow cut into the coast. And they can come back. I mean, this one here probably comes back about 80, 90 metres. And it's pretty narrow. You know, somebody braver than me could probably jump off that rock and land on the other side. You can hear there's fulmars down there. Every so often, one will fly up out of the cut. These stiff wings. The easiest way to identify them from gulls from a distance. And there's three rock doves just sitting up at the top there, just waiting. Gotta stop and try and describe this. There's something, I don't know, sci-fi, almost totalitarian about this. They're building a new harbour, right, just to the south of Aberdeen, to take in cruise ships. So they're building a couple of breakwaters out, and they're using these blocks. Now, they're pretty big. I would say they're maybe about 3.5-4 metres high. If you imagine a rather stubby person, with their arms straight up, that gives you two of the sort of sticky out bits. The legs astride, another two. One sticking out the front, one sticking out the back where the backside would be. So you end up with this sort of odd shape. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these things on the ground in front of me, all lined up in seated ranks, ready to be used when they need them. And they've been explained to me already a couple of years ago when I took a look at the harbour. They put these things down, and as the waves work on them, you know, as the seas batter them, they lock ever tighter together. But to see them lined up like this, you know what it reminds me of? Those tombs in China, the warrior tombs. Bizarre. But very, very visually striking. How incongruous is that? Got high-speed intercity trains heading into Aberdeen. Heavy construction off to my right. And they are fairly coming on with this harbour. And a skylark singing in what was, I think, a landfill site. Well, this is a bit of a poser. There's a sign here, just at the head of the harbour, the construction works, saying, open to a world of possibilities. Well, it might well be open to a world of possibilities, but the path that actually takes you along the coast isn't. And I'm not sure where you're supposed to go. There's a golf course up there, but it's behind a high security fence, so I need to find a way around the fence first before I can go around the outskirts of the golf course. Kind of tempted to sneak up that road, because seriously, it's only about half a mile, but with my luck I'll get caught. How do I get up there? I'll just go up the hill and have a shifty. Found the end of the fence, made my way onto the golf course, walking as close to the edge of the golf course as I can, pushing my bike, because there's an alarming amount of golfers about. Any second I expect to be hitting the back of the nut by a golf ball. Hear that? It's the wind blowing through the barbed wire. Music while you golf. Lighthouses are always so spick and span. Beautiful. White painted, trimmed with a sort of mustard and black bonny. And I envy the folk that have these lighthouse keepers' cottages. What a great place to live and watch the sea from. And just over the top of the pier there, see somebody windsurfing in the bay the other side. And essentially, this is where I'm going to turn around and go back. So the next time, I will pick up, to be honest, probably in Fitty, and head north from there and see how far I get.
Ta-da! There you go. First leg of the Aberdeen Coastal Trail there. There are only two legs, so don't panic. Anyway, Scotland's a great place to spend time in the outdoors, but at the moment, not everyone, sadly, is able to share in the opportunities that are on offer, which is why a group of organisations under the banner of the Scottish Outdoor Recreation Alliance have come together to write a manifesto for the outdoors, full of ideas aimed at supporting the booming demand for the industry. Joining us now to tell us more is SORA member Helen Todd, who's also Rambler Scotland's policy manager. Good morning, Helen. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thanks. It's a bit chilly over here. I'm sure it's the same with you.
Yes, I've got the fire in front of me. I don't care anymore. I've got a cushion from the sofa inside underneath my bottom, and I'm quite happy.
Too much information.
I know. What can you do? Give us a bit of background, Helen. Why is something like this manifesto needed?
Well, we have come together as these organisations. There's mountaineers, cyclists, horse riders, canoeists. We're all coming together because we feel that for years there's been an underinvestment in outdoor recreation and in access management. And this has led to, lots of problems, basically. And we couldn't have really had a better example of this than the pandemic. I mean, nobody would want the pandemic to come along, but it's shown just how much people value being in the outdoors and getting into nature. But also how much the infrastructure and the management of that has been creaking and really massively under pressure. So what we wanted, I mean, we actually came up with the idea of the manifesto long before the pandemic came along, but we've seen things like toilets closing across Scotland. We've seen access officer posts disappearing, ranger service numbers going down, not enough investment in paths and bridges, signposts and so on. And also things like skills development. And it's also starting right from the very beginning with outdoor education being cut. So we wanted to really shine a light on this whole sector and say, look, this sector is massively important for mental health, for physical health, and for the economy as well. And so these are ways of how to support it better. Well, actually, so pretty much everything... go ahead, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, what kind of things are you thinking about? Because obviously we're in the run-up to an election, and because of COVID, I mean, folk are really passionate about it. You know, Mark was talking about the people, you kind of get a bike for love nor money. People are absolutely revelling and enjoying the great outdoors. You know, it's right up there. Are you getting that kind of political support? Are people starting to listen? Actually, this is what people care about.
Yes, very much so. We started talking to the political parties last summer, and very, very warm welcome for this, because they were getting exactly the same messages from local communities, from other people, you know, in their constituencies, who were saying, you know, we really want to welcome people to come here, but we just can't cope. And also lots of people who were going out for the first time were saying, hang on a minute, why are all these paths blocked? Why are these paths not properly maintained? Why can't I find a place to park my car, because there's just, you know, there's no parking here and lots of people are coming. So actually it's really hit a chord. But this is about longer term than just now. I mean, this is something that we've been calling on for a long time, and we want to see long-term investment, because you don't just turn this around in a year of giving a bit more money into the sector. But obviously the government does give money. It gives about £8 million a year for access across the whole country, but that's actually been the same for 10 years. It hasn't changed at all. And a lot of that money just doesn't get through because it's given to the local authorities, and the local authorities don't have to spend it on access. So we're trying to make the case that this is something people really care about, and therefore it should be properly supported, and from the highest level, from government downwards. One of the things we're saying is set up a post for an outdoor recreation champion, because one of the issues is that the benefits are felt in different departments, if you like. So if you have a healthy population, the health spending can reduce or be spent on other things. But you're never going to ask the NHS to put in a new pass up, you know, at Ben Lomond. So it needs to be a cross-departmental thing. And I would say that... go ahead.
No. I was just saying, you're kind of leaning against an open door here. But that outdoor sector, is there that recognition that how vital it is, how important it is? Because, as you were saying, your rangers are disappearing, toilets are closing. There's not the money going in. But you look at the amount of people going to our national parks, and it's absolutely inundated. It should be top of the agenda.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for the last few years, we've been looking at how much economic benefits it brings. And in Scottish residents alone, outdoor recreation is worth £2.6 billion. I mean, that's enormous. Lots of cups of tea and B&Bs and equipment hire and all the rest of it. But also walking tourism, £1.26 billion. So, I mean, these are huge amounts of money spread across the whole country. The government is listening. They have set up a series of working groups, and they now have a 10-year strategy for visitor management, which will cover a lot of this. But, of course, that's the strategy, and we need to make sure that it's not just something that the politicians are looking at now, because it's such a key issue that lots of people are shouting about, and that it continues for another 10 years, that gradually we get more investment into this area. And as I say, it's not just about infrastructure, it's about skills. Because as Mark said earlier, it's at the moment the evidence all shows that people who are not so well off, who are not able to get out by car into the outdoors perhaps, are really missing out. They're not getting the benefits, and we want to make sure that benefits are spread around the whole of society.
There is possibly an argument here, I would imagine, Helen, for saying, let's look at this in a different way. If we assume that COVID's not going away anytime soon, and it is safer for people to be outdoors than it is indoors, you want to encourage more people outdoors, etc., stop thinking about this in terms of recreation and start thinking about it in terms of public health.
Yes, I totally agree. I mean, but at the same time, you know, the management of that comes through the recreation side. I mean, people need to learn about responsible access, to how to make sure they behave properly. I mean, this is a role for access officers. Now, we've seen access officers' posts have dropped. I mean, there were about 65 access officers back in 2006-7, now there's only 36.5, so that's almost halved over the last so many years. And these are the people who can manage all of that activity within a local authority area, and ranger services likewise.
Well, good on you for putting the manifesto together, Helen, and it's been a pleasure speaking to you as ever. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Bye now.
Helen Todd there from Rambler Scotland. And you can read more about the SORA manifesto if you head to our website, and you'll find a link to it there.
We could talk about this all day, yeah, because it is vital. You know, and you've banged on about it. Putting in something like the Aberdeen Bypass without a cycle track beside it, you know, so much could be done.
I was on Good Morning Scotland yesterday morning with Kenny Auld from the Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park, that there is stuff being done, and people need, you know, there is an awareness amongst the various organisations, but it needs to be scaled up, because more and more people are going to want to go out, you know, and it's urgent. It's extremely urgent. So, you're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. We've got heaps more coming up, including a tale of camels in Morocco, and of course, this week's less possibly, I don't know, exotic mystery bird.
I don't know. We should have a mystery camel every week.
Name the camel.
Whole new series in that. Yeah, haven't we listened to this mystery bird? Now, I don't know, are we at the clue stage yet or not?
I don't know. I must confess, if I thought about it hard enough...
Fiona says no.
She's hard. She's maybe small, but she's hard. No, I mean, if I'd thought about that, I probably would have guessed slightly wrong.
Something else you would have guessed... Well, I thought there'd be a lot of people got wrong guesses, but pretty close.
Incredible to think that this is the first, or it's the anniversary of the mystery bird. Because it's something that has grasped the nation by a tender spot. And, you know, and they've indulged in it. They've really gone for this.
Well, they have. And Laura, the one who runs our team, suggested, well, let's just start at the beginning again and play them out and see if anybody's taken it.
See if anybody's notices. There's folk like my dad who every week in life says it's a yellowhammer. And the expectation and hope that the yellowhammer will come back, because we've actually done yellowhammer. I've explained this to him, and he still does it.
Well, I got stopped in street and turf the other day, and somebody said, go and tell us what the mystery bird is this week.
No.
No, I won't.
No,
but it was a dunnock. A dunnock, if you cast your mind back, the tree sparrow. And I remember we were speaking to Roy Dennis a couple of weeks ago, and it is still available on the Scotland Outdoors podcast, that the dunnock had a really lousy PR when it was known as the
hedge sparrow.
Nobody cared about hedge sparrows, and then you called it a dunnock, and suddenly it's a fantastic thing. It's like the change, remember, from killer whale.
Yes.
Nobody liked killer whales, but you start calling them orca, and it's a major tourist attraction. Yeah, you know, people are going. When we get out of this horribleness, people will be flocking to Shetland and Orkney to see orca, not killer whales.
Well, we thought, right, you know, rather than go back to the dunnock, we would find something else avian-related from our archive this week.
Yeah, I thought this one would fit the bill beautifully, and I recorded this back in 2015.
This... it's got to be my favourite time of year. It's clear blue sky just after 7 o'clock at night. The sun's just dipping down over the horizon behind the trees. The leaves aren't out yet. I am surrounded by blackbirds. There's about five or six of them in various trees, right at the top of the trees all around me. But there's one just above me, just outside the house. And he performs beautifully every night about this time. I mean, we've been playing this game for a couple of nights now, and I don't know if he's taking me on or not, but I'm having great fun with it, because he seems to develop his song if you challenge him a wee bit. So I'm going to have a go. Sorry, that's my peacock. Desperate to get in on the act. Massive bird, brain the size of a pea. Anyway, and a bee coming past. It's beautiful signs of impending summer.
Hey,
don't know if you noticed that, but he seems to be adding a little bit on at the end, the stuff I can't do. I mean, listen to this. That kind of... that crackly bit at the end. So I can't do that. And he seems to have added that on. He seems to be revelling in it. See that? Do-do-do-do. We got skinny geese flying overhead. As they fly overhead, we've got a bumblebee getting some post-Easter nectar from the rhododendrons. You know, it's just amazing when you come out of an evening, just the noises you can get. But our blackbird's still showing off. Quite a slow blackbird in the uptake, I think. It's maybe my imagination, but I think he's starting to get it. Well, I'm not convinced, but what a delightful way to spend 5 minutes in the countryside.
I did not believe, unfortunately, that it was following dueling banjos.
It absolutely was.
Yeah, well, we can argue about that at a different time. Jackie in Westcott Bride says she's heading out, he or she, I'm not sure, heading out to check local heronry, doing account for the British Trust for Ornithology. Wee bit chilly here, happy Easter. And Andy in Stirling says, morning from a Crow Noise free Riverside Stirling. Just getting ready to run a series of one-to-one technical rope sessions for members of Ockles Mountain Rescue Team on a quarry edge behind the National Wallace Monument. Coming up, it's that time of year, weather very much permitting, when our thoughts turn towards the garden, once you've scraped the snow off it. We'll have some expert advice in hand very shortly.
Yeah, but first of all, mystery bird. A lot of people getting in touch and they're so close, but they're very wrong. They're kind of... I don't want to make it too easy, but some folk are thinking about connections with the beach. Forget that. No. Have a listen to this. Do you know... Sorry, you were going to say that.
No,
do you know what it is yet?
Well, you've read the script. Well, I've read the script, so I know. Hugh in Orkney says, any chance it's a tree creeper? There is a chance, but not much of a chance, I'm afraid, Hugh. Katie in Perth says, sounds like a wren.
Okay, nope.
Not really. And Doogie no, Dargan Glenrothes says, good morning, gents. Glorious dawn chorus day, which indeed there was, Doogie, you're quite right. Cycling round Loch, leaving tomorrow. That might not be too much fun, Doogie. Have you looked at the weather forecast?
Snow.
And he is actually putting a pretty good guess. Pretty good guess. But it's actually, to my mind, it is so close that I'm not actually going to read out the guess.
Really? Good. Well, sorry, I almost had to stop myself there as well.
Well, yeah, but every month you do that, basically.
Well, we've only, I mean, it was remarkable, actually. In a whole year, we've only blown it once completely. I think you blew it, didn't it?
No, not at all. Wasn't me. Did Ron not play answer in at one stage? No, it was we, Emma. Ron immediately came out and said, wasn't me.
No, it was Emma.
Yeah, it was we, Emma. Yeah, never mind.
Anyway, if you've got an idea where that is, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, 80295 for the text, and call Sam, and it's 0808 592 95 00. It sounds very like something else, yeah. But obviously it It isn't, but you will know what it is.
Remember a couple of weeks ago I said that, you know, she's been helping us with production across, you know, the sort of lockdown period, etc., and she was heading off to do another production. She produced a wee baby boy just about a week ago, so congratulations to her and to her husband. Excellent news. Pammy Jahal, we've spoken to umpteen times in this programme. Pammy's wonderful. She's a force of nature. Ewan and I first came across her when we met up with her on our North Coast 500 trip a few years ago. She's the founder of Backbone, a leading BAME outdoor environmental education organisation.
Yeah, I had the chance recently to meet up with Pammy again at our Backbone HQ in Rothshire. And in the 3.5 years since we'd last spoken, I just want to know how things have been moving on.
Something that's significant has changed for Backbone, and that is, the first one is that we have recognised that the work that we have done with regards to participation and developing leaders in the great outdoors, just as we spoke about in that programme way back then, is still happening, and we're very, very pleased and excited about that, and we are successful. However, something that has struck us really hard is what is actually going on within outdoor and environmental organisations, within the organisations themselves. And what I mean by that is what's going on with regards to BME volunteers, staff, and those sitting at senior levels.
So you're getting that participation, you're seeing that uptick in folk that are interested, but that's not good enough if you've not got role models and people in power.
Yes. So Ewan, you were listening to the last conversation a few years back. I like that you remembered that. That is the heart and soul of any organisation, is its people. And if its people is not representing the people they serve, how can they possibly serve all the communities that they say they serve?
Well, how can you change that? Because folk have been talking about this for a long time and nothing's happening.
Yes, and that is our biggest frustration. I'll remind you of our journey. Well, I set up in 1995. I came back from America and I realised there was no other folks looking like me that were in the outdoor world. And in 2000, we were interviewed by BBC Countryfile and we were shouting and bawling about the lack of diversity in outdoor organisations then. And do you know what? In 2010... we were on BBC Countryfile shouting and bawling about the lack of diversity in outdoor organisations then. And now this last decade, we are still talking about you. And, you know, we've been asked to be keynote speakers left, right and centre. And this last year, there's been a massive movement with regards to BME and the lack of diversity in the outdoor world. And we're talking about it. And to be frank, quite frank, I'm tired of talking about it. The time has come to action change at that level, the level of volunteering, employment and sitting in senior board level.
Are you suggesting that there's a ceiling? Well, are we talking about institutional racism here?
Yes, I am talking about that. And, you know, we are running a symposium right now and it's fantastic. Because the question that symposium is asking is exactly that. I'm asking the outdoor organisation network, are we, and we're including ourselves in that, are we institutionally racist? And I believe, and this is from Pammy Jahal as the founder of Backbone and the experience of Pammy Jahal as a practitioner of 40 years, I believe that the sector is racist. Now, there's a spectrum along that racism. We have allowed our outdoor and environmental organisations to get away with what I would call institutional racism for way too long. And that has to end and it has to be challenged.
What about how, Pammy, do you change it? Because I get the impression, or you're giving me the impression, that people have had, you know, they've consulted, they've ticked boxes, they've thought about it and done nothing. So it need to come from government and say, actually, you get funding from us, sort it out.
Yes. Now, I'm going to go the tick boxing, which is what I call genuine intention. You're absolutely right. You know, right now it is law that every organisation has to have what we call diversity and inclusion, mission statement and targets. And therefore, you know, what's been rolled out right now is a number of what I call boardroom diversity and inclusion training models out there, and also a number of going to events where you can say we are doing the right thing to tick the right box and meet the targets. And we, Backbone, have fallen into that. We have been used for those to tick the targets and to say we have been done some diversity and inclusion training. That's not enough. What we need to see is things physically change within organisations. And clearly that is not. There is research that has been done, and research has been going on for 30, 40 years. And we have spent vast amount of money, as in organisations have paid vast amount of money, to go on and harp on about research. You just need to look in outdoor organisations. We just need to physically walk into outdoor organisations' offices, and there is a clear, visible lack of BME representation. That is what we mean by actioning change. That level needs to change.
Pammy, can it change? An easy question from me, a difficult answer from you. How do you change it quickly?
Right. I don't think it's going to be a quick solution. However, I didn't expect it to be as slow as 40 years, which is totally outrageous. This symposium is a process, and a process of understanding and fact-finding as opposed to working with assumption and perceptions. Now, the fact-finding is where we are sending out questionnaires so that we can capture different perspectives. We're capturing BME member perspectives, so different organisations and BME perspectives from the diverse range of BME communities that are out there. We're not just one big clump. We're also capturing facts with regards to BME engagement across what I call the sector, but actually what I mean by that is outdoor organisations. And again, there is a whole spectrum of outdoor organisations. So we want to know what is going on within those organisations. And then the third perspective is my perspective, not just mine, but there are a number of what I call BME practitioners that have been in the field for as long as I have. And they have had experiences, and some of them have not been very pleasant indeed. And we're capturing that so that we are working from fact. The good news is this symposium is open to outdoor organisations, environmental organisations, the whole spectrum, and also BME members and organisations. And right now, particularly from the BME organisation point of view, the last 2-3 years, particularly after the Black Lives Matter movement, there are some amazing, young, vibrant, what I call social groups out there with huge numbers that are just gagging and are getting out into the outdoors in their own network because that's where they feel safe.
But you're not in danger, Pammy, and I really, you're going to bite my head off here. Big organisations take your symposium, say thank you very much. That's another box that'd be ticked, and they use you again.
Well,
you're going to tell me it's not going to happen.
Well, too bloody right, it's not going to happen. I'm sorry for saying that, but it's not going to happen. Oh, Backbone will be holding everybody to account. Those that are coming to the symposium, every single organisation, and I'm talking in the last month and a half, I have probably had over 100 interviews with people. And I've clearly stated that this is not a box ticking exercise, and we expect you to action change. And what action change looks like is there will be resources put behind this. This is not about attending a one event. And if folks do attend that one event, they will be exposed. I'm sorry, but this is about action and change. But more importantly, when I say they are going to be exposed, I don't feel that is going to happen at all. Because those folks that have signed up to the symposium, we feel that this is different. The energy behind it is different. And everybody is ready to action change. Now, I am going to put a little caveat with that. I cannot predict the future. But what I do know is I have energy. I challenge. I don't sit there and take things lightly. I never have done. Hence, Backbone has been doing what it's been doing. So we will challenge. And those that have been receipt of our challenging conversations know that we will challenge. We have worked with organisations, big organisations, significant organisations, where we have provided consultations for a year solutions and where they have fundraised and got the money for our solutions, yet just offered us a third of that money, the funds that they raised. And we have said, no, we will not work with you because it's ethically that is not right. I've got to be honest, it's not just Backbone. The new groups that are out there, where we're hoping that they will embrace what we will have to offer, which is we want to build robust, safe BME outdoor organisations that will lead the way in this change. And they will lead the way with even more vigour than I have, because they're a lot younger than I am. And they will challenge the sector just as much as we are.
I'm perhaps painting a negative picture. I'm challenging you on this because it's a big problem and you've got a big hill to overcome. But are there positives at the end of this?
Yes, there is. But I'm with you as well with regards to it being quite negative. You know, I can give you some clear racist incidents that we have had, and some quite recently that I've heard from other BME practitioners that are in awful states at the moment. However, the good news is the energy, those that have signed up to the symposium, they are ready to challenge us, seriously ready to challenge us. Some organisations that have brought us in to be keynote speakers say, please challenge us, Pammy, because we have had enough of kind of skirting the issue. They want this issue to be addressed head on and action change. So I'm feeling really positive about this.
As I said, a force of nature, Pammy Juhal of Backbone.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point Pammy's making, and I totally agree with her, until you have representation from those diverse communities, right at the top, not members, you know, people in the organisation, then it's not going to change. You know, there's that whole ceiling that needs to be broken.
Indeed, indeed.
Anyway, we welcome your thoughts on that. 0808 592 95 00. Quite a few folk getting in touch with us about the birds, and satisfyingly wrong. top of the list is George Anderson, who knows these birds in Joppa. Fantastic, George. You're totally wrong. Not totally wrong. Is it that? I've seen them on the River Tweed and expect them on the River Esk near Musselburgh. Best wishes from George in sunny Joppa. Marion Kyle in Oxford said, is it a or is it a Well, they're all quite similar, but you've actually named the two that it isn't, which is great.
Yeah.
Sometime I remember you discussing parakeets in the wild. We saw one in Oxford yesterday, striking. And Patricia Fraser in Blair Gowrie said, good morning, I think it is a goldcrest. And absolutely not, Patricia. Fantastic.
Well, that's
the wrong answers coming in.
Gay Burt from Gargunnock also thought it was a goldcrest. Starling's quite popular. Sandy in Dunlugas says, is the Mr. Bird a starling? No, no, no. Pam and Lossie says, must be a starling this morning. They'll mimic whatever it was if it's not. That's clever, but wrong, Pam. Just opening a window. Yeah, very clever. Just opening a window reminds me how double glazing shuts out birdsong as well as jet noise from the drone, which is fair enough. Margaret and Bucky thought it was a wren. Margaret and Alan thought it was a wren. And Lackey and Troon thought it was a wren. None correct, I'm afraid.
Well, yeah, we'd have thought
getting close.
Well, they're getting so close. I mean, it's the only one that folk haven't said yet.
Yeah.
It's very easy. Do we get clues yet or not?
One more. Just, you know, and then we'll give a clue. Cemeteries are fascinating places. I really enjoy wandering around cemeteries. I find them fascinating places. There's just so much information and colour and sort of background and history in them. Peter Ross is also similarly afflicted. He's recently published an excellent book called Tomb with a View, The Stories and Glories of Graveyards. Robbie Armstrong met up with Peter at Cathcart Cemetery in Glasgow.
It was founded in 1878, and it covers a space of 43 acres, and there's 15,000 graves here. And I think, at the time, this would have been, in some ways, a status symbol to be buried here. I mean, we're at the top of the cemetery now, and we can see a lot of really huge headstones, tombstones around us. Some of them have been toppled, but some of them still stand. And this was a place where you could put up a stone and it would reflect, you know, not just the depth of your grief and not just the depth of your faith, but also the depth of your pockets. This was a place to be seen. You know, it was, as I say, it reflected one's status within the city and within the country.
I
think I've always been interested in cemeteries. Ever since I was a little boy, I used to hang around in the Old Town Cemetery in Stirling. That was my playground, essentially. It was where I effectively learned to read. You know, I remember kind of sounding out unfamiliar names on the stones. I think when you find a favourite cemetery, it's a bit like a woodland walk that you enjoy or a hill that you enjoy climbing. You become very, very used to it if you visit it many times and you begin to develop familiar and favourite places. And this, for me, is definitely one of them. It's a 19th century headstone that has... What's happened is it's been put up and then over time a beech tree has self-seeded behind it and has grown up behind it. And that has forced the stone in time to topple back onto the trunk of the beech tree, which, as the years have passed, has begun to consume it from above. So it's eating it from the top down, essentially. It's quite sinister in some ways, quite ghoulish, but also amazingly kind of thrilling and weirdly attractive if you're into that sort of thing. And of course, in time, if the tree lives, it will completely consume that stone. So one day, there will be a beech tree with a gravestone completely inside it. And it's just one of the great sights of the cemetery for me. I love it.
And you come walking here very regularly?
Yeah, I mean, I always came in here regularly because I live so near to it. This is essentially my local cemetery. It's pretty much behind my house. But since lockdown, I've been in here almost every single day. I mean, this is where we come for our daily walk. And I never get bored of it. You know how people say when you live beside the sea, the sea always looks different at different times of year and in different weather? Well, I think that an old graveyard is exactly the same. You know, you come here at certain times of year, certain times of day, and the sun will be shining just perfectly on a particular headstone, just lighting it up like a spotlight. So it's kind of thrilling to see those changes, and you never quite know what you're going to find. We're now in spring, and I've noticed over the last few weeks, we had the snowdrops, and then we had the crocuses, and now just this week we've had the primulas. But at the same time, there's still a carpet of fallen brown leaves. So it kind of feels like autumn and spring are going on simultaneously here. And it is very thrilling to come and see seasonal change, see the wild garlic begin to come out. And just in the last few weeks, really hearing the bird song beginning to be really noisy. We're up here at the highest point in the cemetery, and it really is an extraordinary view in most directions. I mean, we can see away over to the north the People Make Glasgow sign looming above George Square. You know, beyond that, we can see towards the Campsie Fells and the Hill of Dumgoyne over there, the sort of elephant's head shape that's got. Further over there to the west, you can actually see towards the mountains around Loch Lomond. And if we look over there, just to the south between the trees, you can see the turbines of Whiteley Wind Farm. So really an incredible panorama that you get from this space. It's worth coming here just for the view alone.
I like this cemetery because it feels like it's somewhere in between a man-made space and nature. And not just, I mean, I know there's not really a distinction between, you know, nature and civilization, but here you really feel like it's a mix in between, with the sort of all the trees growing back, and there's almost like a woodland over that area, which is It just feels like you're in this sort of strange liminal zone almost.
Absolutely. I mean, like a lot of the great Victorian cemeteries, when this was laid out and towards the end of the 19th century, in 1878 it was opened, it would have been a garden. This was a garden that people would come and they would visit their loved ones, and they could promenade the paths and they could enjoy the spectacle of this beautiful, pristine space. But over time, inadvertently, it's become a kind of wood. And almost all the trees that we see around us, and there's many of them, will be self-seeded. If you go into the interior, I mean, I've heard that referred to as the jungle, you know. It really is full of dense undergrowth, hidden stones, ivy. And yeah, that's part of the attraction of these places, that they have become green spaces within the city. You know, they're amazing spaces for nature and for wildlife. I mean, I love coming in here and seeing all the different birds. I mean, you know, apart from the usual birds, I've seen woodpeckers in here, owls, you know, bats, of course, at night. And I've seen foxes in here all the time. I've even seen deer on occasion. So it really is an amazing wildlife space as well.
I saw people having a little sort of picnic, like with their kid or their grandkid. And they were just sitting at the Commonwealth Cross, at the entrance. it does seem like a public space there to be sort of enjoyed almost, which is maybe counterintuitive to how some people might view a cemetery.
I mean, people come in here all the time for walks. They walk their dog in here every day. But certainly people come in, especially in the warmer weather, and they will sit and put a picnic rug down. I've done it myself. I've sat up here, I remember, and listened to the sounds of the Arctic Monkeys kind of drifting over from Glasgow Green, which is about 4 miles away. But yeah, people come here and they just hang out, or they'll come here and they'll have a wee drink at night and enjoy the incredible view, enjoy the sunset. And I personally do not find that disrespectful. As long as they take away their empties, I'm sure the dead don't begrudge people coming in here and having a drink. I'm sure they enjoy the company.
Peter Ross there with Robbie Armstrong, and we'll have more from them over the coming weeks as they take a look at some of the more unusual headstones in Cathcart Cemetery. I don't find anything odd, you know, in sitting around in a cemetery.
No, absolutely not. I was just putting, two of us putting flowers on my mother's grave 2 days ago, and just wandering around the old gravestones, and it's absolutely fascinating. But I remember a couple of years ago, I did a half-hour programme on gravestones. And some of the more... There was two that I remember vividly. Here lies the body of Willie Langham. If you saw him now, you wouldn't ken him. There was another one. Here is the body of Georgie Anderson, an honest lawyer. A rare beast.
We used to stay just in the corner of the Links in Peterhead, and there's a really good cemetery the other side of the Links, and I used to wonder about that when I was a kid. And there's one grave in there, and it's a mother, a father, and I think a son, and they were all Inuit. They'd come to Peterhead on a whaler, and I think it was the smallpox carried them off. But, you know, it's just there's so much history in these places. It's fascinating. Folk are still struggling with this week's mystery, but we're going to give you just a wee clue in a second. But first, here's what it sounds like.
That's got to be easy, surely.
No, I really don't. No? I mean, when you played it for a start, I said it wasn't particularly easy. It's not.
Well, I'll give you a bit. It comes from the French word martlet, and a martlet is a mythical beast that's used in heraldry, and it has no feet because according to mythology it never lands.
Is that
any easier or not?
I don't know, we'll see. Give us a call. 0808 92 95 00. This Monday a few things in Scotland can reopen: hairdressers and barbers. Not particularly excited by either of those two, truth to be told. Car showrooms will also be back up and running. But most importantly, garden centres will be opening their doors. That's great news for heaps of folk, because when folk get really passionate about gardening. Joining us now to tell us all about what we should be doing in the garden this time of year is Kirsty Wilson, herbaceous supervisor at the Royal Botanic Garden Edinburgh and one of the presenters of BBC Scotland's Beech Grove. Good morning, Kirsty. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show. Hear from both of you.
It's our great pleasure. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. I mean, it's kind of almost axiomatic. I mean, gardening is enormously, enormously popular. It's getting more popular.
Yeah, and I think in the last lockdown, last year, I think so many new gardeners were found. You know, people that were at home, they tried some sunflowers, say, on the windowsill, and they had some success. So we've got this whole new sort of generation of gardeners coming into it, as well as everyone else who loves it as well. So it's a great time to know that garden centres are opening back up, and you know, smaller garden centres that weren't able to open, you know, we can now go there and get our supplies and get inspired and, you know, get the garden ready for spring and all these spring new growth and the flowers. The rhododendrons at the botanics at the moment are just outstanding, so it's just a lovely time of year to be out in nature.
So what kind of things should we be doing? I mean, I noticed Mark's going to mock me for this.
Yes, I am.
The asparagus is now about an inch high.
Yes. Get the asparagus knife out.
Am I the only one with an asparagus knife? But what should we be doing? I mean, the potatoes were there within inches of being planted yesterday, and then looked at the forecast and said, oh, let's put them back. I mean, is it too late for folk to get organised for that?
Well, you can plant your potatoes this weekend, just, you know, do watch where you are weather-wise. But, it's one of those, you start bringing things on and we get to that stage where we're hardening things off. you know, putting them out during the day, bringing them in at night. So it's just like building them up. And it's a good time to sow your hardy annuals, so like calendula and sunflowers.
What's a hardy annual anyway?
So ones that are going to be a wee bit tougher and able to survive if you, you know, you harden them off and put them out. And lawns are, it's critical at this moment now to do any repairs and feed your lawn, maybe put down some seed. You know, the soil's starting to warm up. If you want to feed some of your roses, it's maybe good to put down some chicken manure. If some of your roses are going quite rambling and wild, you can tie them in. And of course, if we keep on top of the weeds right now, we'll get ahead of them, and it means you'll have an easier job later on in the summer.
Don't talk to me about lawns. Don't talk to me about lawns. I tell you, because, I mean, yes, it's fine, the grass is beginning to come through and what have you, but this is the time of year when, you know, if a mummy rabbit and a daddy rabbit love each other very much, and the daddy rabbit's trying to impress the mummy rabbit by digging big holes in my lawn. It's called a butt scrape, and it's just, I mean, it's carnage.
God, yeah, well, you want to rabbit proof your garden.
Well, it's not possible if you've got, you know, I call it a tennis court, some people call it a field, but the badgers just love digging it up.
Yeah, they can be quite disruptive, you know, they will like uproot the whole lawn and things. But, you know, that's wildlife and that's part of gardening as well. So we sometimes have got to live with it. You can't, you know, there are trends now to have more wildflower meadows and things, so we don't have to have that neat manicured lawn anymore. We can do our bit for pollinators and bees and wildlife, so don't feel too under pressure to get it looking perfect.
No, I've never had a neat manicured lawn. I've no idea what that's like, truth to be told.
Not a bowling green.
No, certainly not a bowling green. The thing is about gardening too, it's yes, it's physical exercise, but it's kind of good for the, you know, for your mind as well.
Yeah, I think like both physically and mentally, it's great for your health. So, you know, yeah, it's like almost a green gym out there. It is hard work, and a lot of people don't realise that sometimes. And then it's got the same benefits of being out in nature and woodland, you know. And, you know, sometimes you can just zone out completely when you're, you know, digging over that patch or weeding an area. You know, you can forget about the stress and troubles of life. So, yeah, I think it's a happy place.
What about independent garden centres? Because I'm about at least an hour from one of the big chains, and you know, they kind of, they've been really, really struggling, and even getting plants. You can't get plants from Holland anymore. You know, it's a strange world.
I think it's been a difficult time for them, so I think that even more important for us to go out on Monday when things open and just go and support them. And they do say that you should buy a plant every month throughout the year from a garden centre, and then you'll have year-round interest in your garden. So that's a great excuse to go once a month to your garden centre, or even more. But I think it'll be lovely to be able to go and support them again and just get the supplies that we need.
This is kind of a serious time. It's a serious question, Kirsty, because, you know, I often wonder this. You know, that there are folk who are really, really, really keen on gardening, you know, and they're busy. And we've got a pal, Eleanor, who's like this. I mean, she just cannot sit still, will not sit still. It's constantly weeding, constantly chopping stuff down, constantly moving stuff about and things like that. Do you ever actually just take time just to sit? Just sit down and enjoy it. Just absorb.
No.
Yeah, well, I think, like, even in my own work at the Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, I like to sometimes, after hours or sort of finish my working hours, I like to go and sit or wander around the garden with my camera and then appreciate what you've created. So I think that's really important. And they always say, as a garden designer, you should create seating areas within your garden that you can sit and have your sundowner, or, you know, just enjoy that last bit of sun going down. And I think that bit of pottering in the evening, even in your garden, just pulling a few weeds, you know, you don't have to be doing it all the time, but I think you do need to enjoy it as well.
There's an old Robert Burns expression, you know, whiskey and freedom gang together. Well, I would contend that gardening and gin go together.
I agree.
Just sit out in the sunshine and just enjoy it, and the drone of bees and things like that. No, it's great. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole part of it, isn't it? Yeah. Have a gin garden, maybe.
Yeah, now there's a possibility. There is a possibility.
Nice herbs for them.
Yeah, quite. Kirsty, thank you very much for joining this morning. That was kind of you.
Thank you. And Beechgrove's on tomorrow morning at 9:30 on BBC Two.
Shameless.
Shameless. just contractually obligated to get that in. actually, the new series of BBC, new series of Beech Grove is on the BBC Scotland channel on Thursdays at 8 p.m. See, I can do it too, as well as being available on streaming site BritBox North America. Landward's going to be in that too, isn't it?
Yeah, we're on it. You talked about gardening. I was filming on Monday down in near Moffat, and we just set up the cameras and about to interview this lovely guy, and suddenly there's a blur as his wife hurtled across the patio and said, "No!" and immediately started weeding the plant.
You sure it was his wife and not your wife?
Oh, it was just so funny. She said, "You can't film this." And she weeded out this pot and then said, "Okay, go ahead."
Oh, for the love of goodness, honestly.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. Anyway, you're listening to The Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's your McElraith. That's a herring gull. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Actually, the herring gull just flew past with what looks like a morning roll in its mouth.
Well,
very odd, very odd. It's like those planes that you used to use for hunting submarines. Or you can download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing where you listen. Email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Kelly O'Donnell in Canada did, saying, "Hi, Mark, Ewan, and the whole Out of Doors team. I've wanted to send an email of gratitude for your show for a long while now, but never knew where to start, so here goes. Even before the pandemic struck, I was an avid listener to the programme. As an engineer and someone who thoroughly enjoys being out in nature, I love your podcast. From stories on Highland search and rescue, St Kilda evacuations, forests and rewilding, to agricultural communities and electric vehicles. The show really captures it all. It is my go-to podcast on Saturday mornings here in Ottawa."
That was fantastic. She goes on to say, "I've never been to Scotland, and prior to listening to the podcast, I'd never even considered travelling there. Now, I long to visit a place I have never known. And funnily enough, after all this time listening to the podcast, I now know where all the name places in the Canadian Maritime comes from, where I grew up. Even here in Ontario and out in Alberta, BC, Huntly, Banff, and literally every town in Cape Breton is a reminder of their Scottish roots. She says it's funny to hear those names related to Scotland and not to Canada. Sending much health and happiness to you both and all the Out of Doors team. Much appreciation, Kelly."
We were talking earlier about, you know, the fact that Canadian place names are very often Scottish place names. Years ago, I was doing something at the Edinburgh Festival, and we were invited to a barn dance by the Canadian Theatre Company next door. And they said, "You know, ladies and gentlemen, that's the Manitoba Two-Step." You know, we were starting this thinking, and they were saying, "Gee, you guys really catch on to this quick." They had nicked all our dances and just renamed them. So you're going, "This is the Gay Gordons. This, I could do this, you know, doing this in my sleep." Anyway, this is BBC Radio Scotland. You're listening to Out of Doors. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. Do have a listen to this week's edition of Travelling Folk on BBC Sounds, where they paid tribute to legendary bothy ballad singer Jock Duncan, who's just died at the age of 95. Jock recorded his first CD at the ripe old age of 71 and was instrumental in preserving the traditional songs of the Northeast. Here's a wee clip from the programme, Travelling Folk, where Jock's grandson Gordy and fellow bothy ballad singer Joe Aiken remember him.
There was no Biggsy-ness about him. He was just Jock. But Lochry Jock was what he often got called, like. And the unfortunate thing is Jock probably, you know, the last Ains that's singing songs that he really had lived, you can, the working of the horse and I mean, I can mind of the horse on the fern, but I never actually worked on myself. But what a legacy he's left us, his songs and the CDs and tapes, you know, we've got most of his stuff taped, like.
To me, my earliest memories are more to do with, like, melodies of bothy ballads and my granddad practising for competitions and practising in the living room, and he loved his muckle songs, so you're talking songs that had, you know, lots and lots of verses to remember. There'd be comical moments where I remember my granddad was halfway through one of these muckle songs and he kind of stuttered and he forgot where he was going with this verse and my granny just sort of quietly turns around and utters a sentence and then he just sprung back into action and then just knew the words instantly. So it was nice to see that dynamic between them. She knew the songs as well as he did, you know.
Gordy Duncan there and his grandfather Jock, and you hear the full tribute on Travelling Folk on BBC Sounds. Joe Aiken's an absolute national treasure as well.
Oh, he's fantastic. I remember a couple of years back on Landward, somebody said, well, I did it without my knowing. They entered me into the Turriff Bothy Ballad competition. And I went down and Joe gave me some tuition. You know, that's the scariest thing I've ever done. Yeah. Standing up there with cameras and people who really, really know what they're doing and singing their songs. So it was, it was quite an eye-opener.
There's still time to hazard a guess at our mystery bird this week. Let's just hear it one more time again. Steve Chadwick is so close. Steve Chadwick is so close. He says, I think the mystery birds are sand martins. I saw a group of 40 this week on a walk down the Suffolk coast. Spring is here. Alistair and Elgin thought it was a hedge sparrow, and then we just docked it on the head. And then says, respectfully suggest two gentlemen who present on radios, outdoor ambassadors for Scotland. I say, if it comes with a uniform, I'm the man for the job.
And you absolutely.
Could, and he also goes, and you could have your own range of confectionery. I don't understand that, but I'll take it. That's not a problem. Andy Ross near Bewley says, is it a wheatear? Nope. Peter and Balerno thought it was a linnet, but now thinking it's a twite. Nope, nope. Gary and Pennycook said, mystery bird, a swallow. No, but so close. And Richard from North Lincolnshire said, love listening to the programme. Can I venture a guess? Is it a sedge warbler? That's too sophisticated for us, Richard, but it's a very good guess.
Yeah, I mean, the swallow is wrong, mm-hmm. and it's not a swift. What else is left? And they're also heading to the used to nest in cliffs, and then they abandoned that as people's mm-hmm. buildings got better, and they're on their way.
Indeed. Over the past couple of weeks, if you don't get it from that lot, you just pull the duvet over your head and just go back to sleep. Over the past couple of weeks, we've been hearing from broadcaster and blogger Penny Latton, who's been sharing her experience of recovering from breast cancer. Before the cancer, Penny was a hardcore road cyclist. Now, we're talking vast distances over the hilliest of terrain, races, the lot. But not being able to get out like she used to was really a bit of a shock to her, until she bought an e-bike.
Well, today I'm cycling along the towpath of the Caledonian Canal between Dochgarroch, where the Caledonian Canal joins the River Ness, and Inverness. It's only a short route, probably about 3 miles, and it has become amazingly popular over lockdown. So many people come and do the loop up to Dochgarroch and back round to the Muirton Basin, either walking, often with their dogs, or by bike, as I am today. Now, if you listen carefully, you might just hear my bike purring, because it's an electric bike. So what you might say? Well, for me, as someone who used to cycle a lot of miles on my road bike, and in fact, when I was diagnosed with cancer, I was training for a couple of events, getting an electric bike felt weird, like a lot weird. But because of the surgery I had, I have had problems reaching forwards, so I struggle on a traditional racing bike, whereas the e-bike is much more upright, as well as putting less stress in general on my body. So having an e-bike is a great idea. Having said that, actually making the decision to get an electric bike felt huge, and I wrote about it for my blog. Eating breakfast at my friend Bruce and Joe's bar, Joe suggested I have a quick spin round the block on her electric bike. It seemed a serendipitous suggestion. Earlier in the week, I'd caught up with another friend, Al, who'd suggested I come and have a try of some e-bikes they got to help people recovering from cancer. Then he said, I wish I'd got mine sooner. It's changed everything. I wanted to say no. I wanted to push the idea of sitting on that bike away. I wanted to sink into my feeling that it would be cheating. But with Al's words so fresh in my head, I gave in and I gave Joe's bike a go. So now, only hours later, here we were in the car driving to the bike shop to buy an electric bike. I lean my head against the window and cry. Why does this feel so much like defeat? This bike will allow us to get back out cycling together, to share something we love. I can stop feeling so sad each Saturday when I watch David, my partner, head off with the cycle club. Now I'll be able to join him. With any luck, the e-bike will allow me to cycle fast enough to comfortably keep up. because I've been worrying that even when I can get on my bike without my body buckling, I'll be so unfit and slow that riding with me will be torture. And once I'm fit enough, well enough, I can turn off the power. But every time I picture myself on an e-bike, I flinch. There's no getting round it. It feels like I've failed, that I'm accepting that this is as good as I can get, that I'm stuck at this point. It hurts so much, and I feel so angry again that this has happened to me. I hate this disease so much. I want to hit out at it, pummel it, show it how furious I am at it stealing great chunks of who I am. Maybe it's because I'm coming up against something I used to do so much of that it feels more difficult. I find it so hard to push away the memory of my being able to cycle many miles. I know that by comparison, now, I come up so very short. This new bike will force me to confront what I was once capable of, force me to face myself in the mirror. But I also know to sit around waiting to be well enough to cycle is also conceding some kind of defeat to my cancer. So I dry my face on my sleeve, take a breath, and follow David into the shop to buy a way of moving forward. Reading that back now, it's quite difficult because I remember so vividly how upset I was. I haven't regretted buying the e-bike for a second. I love cycling here along the canal into Inverness, and it has definitely got me cycling more than I think I ever would have done if it was just my normal bike. It's also fun to ride. I even attached a basket to the front so I can do some shopping with it. If I'm honest, I still really miss being as fit as I used to be, I think. I miss being able to cycle long distances through the incredible landscape we have here in the Highlands. And I did that with all my friends, so I miss that aspect too. I just miss the person I was before cancer. I was talking to another friend who's battled cancer this past year, and she said cancer changes you forever. There is no returning to normal because normal doesn't exist in the same way. So in a sense, I guess there's no returning to who I was before because I'm not that same person. I think the cycling, maybe more than anything else, is something I still struggle with. I guess because there's no more vivid reminder of what's happened to me. I had wondered whether it would be kinder to myself to just give up cycling altogether rather than have a kind of halfway house that I now sit in. But I love moving through the world on a bike. I love the way it lets you absorb the landscape. I love the way it makes time disappear. So I haven't lost hope. I have signed up for an event which I ideally love to be able to cycle on my road bike. But if not, then this very lovely e-bike will get me round, because cancer can steal many things from me, and it has. But it isn't taking this part of my life. No way.
Penny Latham there, on her e-bike on the Caledonian Canal. And you can read more about her experiences in our blog, pennylatin.co.uk. That's PennyLatin, all one word, .co.uk. Very, very honest. Because of their natural ability to conserve water, camels have long been the main form of transport in the deserts of North Africa. So when adventurer Alice Morrison decided to move to Morocco and explore that part of the world, they were an obvious choice.
But camels aren't always the friendliest of beasts, as Alice explains. But once you get to know them...
I love my camels now, especially Hamish, who I miss. I spent a lot of time up in the West Highlands when I was a child on holidays, and I loved riding, like all girls, you know, eight on, it was all about ponies. And I just remember being rolled on and tossed off lots of little Shetlands and then Highlands, who were just so stubborn. And camels are like that on speed. They are so naughty. I mean, they bite. They're double jointed in their legs, so they can kick to the side and just whack you unawares if you're too close. They spit, they roar, they pee on your stuff. They are not an easy animal, but once you get to know them, you get to love them.
Why do you miss Hamish so much? Because he tried to bite your head off.
He did. I was wearing a pink bobble cap because it's very cold at night in the desert. And I was wearing my pink bobble cap. And I think he thought I was a very large strawberry. And he just put his jaws right round my head. I was like, Hamish, get off. Let's be stereotypical. All girls like a bad boy.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's Wilfred Thesiger. He wrote about seeing a man being literally picked up by the head by a bull camel. The camel's jaws just went across the top of this guy's head, picked him off the ground, and threw him over a wall. They can be quite dangerous.
Male camels are dangerous, and they're dangerous when they're in heat. And actually, for two of my legs of my expedition, our camels were in heat and they're all male. A male camel can take your arm off. You have to treat them absolutely with caution. They fight for supremacy. So it's a very traditional kind of animal family in that there'll be, say, 5 or 8 female camels, and there'll be one male who fights for supremacy and then dominates that small harem. I won't say they're aggressive, but they will fight. And when their hormones are up, you certainly have to be very wary. And I always was. And I mean, one of the Arabic words that was used probably most often on our journey was khatar, which means danger. And always, like Brahim or Adi would be yelling, Zahra, khatar, as I went to kind of try and stroke Hamish. They'd be like, no, move away. Don't do that. He'll bite you. So approach with caution.
You clearly love the desert environment. Why do you like that? Because I think I might struggle with spending a lot of time in what could be perceived as a barren landscape.
It gets into your soul. You know, when you go up to the Highlands and you've got miles and miles of heather moorland and a big sky and a feeling of being a very small part of the earth, but a very connected part of the earth. That is the feeling you get in the desert. It's so free and liberating, and especially in this time of corona where we're constrained, that feeling of freedom is precious in every breath you take. You're tiny, you're inconsequential, you can be crushed by nature at any point, but you do have that feeling of being a part of the world, like your feet are on the ground, your head is in the sky, you're walking through the air. It's a very strong awareness of being alive. I think that's why I love it.
Explorer Alice Morrison there, and you hear more about Alice's adventures on the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available now from BBC Sounds. Listen, we're running really short of time this week, so we're going to reveal this week's mystery bird, and it is the house martin.
As we speak, tiny masters of the air are turning their heads north and heading to Scotland, the rest of the UK, and to Europe. All winter long, they have fed on insects in African skies. But now, as the call to breed strengthens, they seek a new land. Every spring, over 90 million martins will cross the Sahara, many destined for ancient ancestral homes. Delightful, tiny birds with a steel blue back, a white underbelly, and the distinctive white rump, which makes it easy to distinguish from a swallow. And the martin, unlike its cousin the swallow, isn't a squatter nesting inside barns and sheds. No, the martin still has a close connection with man, but prefers to build a nest on the outside of a house. Pre-17th century, the country's martin population would be found on cliffs and crags, nesting in cracks and crevices. But as man's buildings improved, they simply moved out and took possession of the safety provided by overhanging roofs. Difficult for most predators to get at, and the perfect launch pad for flight. Because flight is what a martin is all about. And here we enter the world of avian speculation. The Migration Atlas states that aerial roosting must be suspected, suggesting that the martins never touch land from the day they leave our shores until they return. Swallows roost in large numbers, making them easy to catch and to ring, but data on martins is almost non-existent. Current theories suggest at night they fly higher and higher and spend the whole evening sleeping at incredible altitude. And there are physiological adaptations that back up the theory. Unlike swallows, they have long johns, feathered legs like the ptarmigan and the grouse, to protect them from the cold of the upper atmospheres. It fits. And there's more. The word marten comes from the French martlet, a mythical bird without feet, which never roosts and is constantly on the wing, like an avian Flying Dutchman. The early arrivals head for the nests of their ancestors, patching them up with small mud pellets. If they can claim an old nest, then two broods are the norm. Late arrivals or younger birds have to start from scratch. And it can take 2 weeks to assemble the 1,000 pellets necessary to prepare for the arrival of the eggs. But you can help. A top tip from the 18th century wildlife writer Gilbert White suggests fixing large scallop shells under the eaves to provide a base for the nest. Although you can buy a wood pulp and cement nest to provide an instant home. A home which protects the chicks from the ravages of woodpeckers who have the nasty habit of pecking through the mud.
Wonderful. Quick list of people who got it right. Dave in Carlisle, Derek in Forth, Laura and McGregor in Aberfeldy, and Pamela in Edinburgh, and Derek Doogie Garby and Glenn Rothis and Ian Johnson all got it right. Well done, guys.
I've got a list too, you know. Ross and Tainalt, Becky and Taunton, Coxie and Dunkeld, Evelyn Cook, Keith Sutherland and Blair Gowrie, Jackie Wescobride, Nicola and John Fletcher, Ochtermachty, David Long, John and Kingoldrum, Isabel Skye, Ian Strathpeffer, Hazel Aberdeen, Lynn and Rod Kirkbodo. We're waiting for them to arrive, usually up to 12 to 16 pairs each year. Wow. And Catherine Gallashiel says, is the Mr. Bird a house marten? Yes, indeed. It took a long while for that actually to come to fruition, but you know, those clues at the end seem to have helped a bit.
Yeah, Mary in St. Andrews very briefly said, we're talking about blackbirds. It was described at the BTO as begins on a flute and ends on a piccolo.
Oh, no, that's lovely.
I'll steal that.
Begins in a flute and ends in a year. We'll be using that at some stage at some dinner party or another. That's it from us. Don't forget the Scotland Outdoors podcast at noon today, and look out for the midweek podcast in which I speak to Sandy Knapp, botanist at the Natural History Museum in London. Thanks for listening.